we've seen the dark side, and it's kind of like, it's kind of forced a lot of my friends to say, what am I really getting out of this? Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about the effects of big data and social media on public opinion. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next.
Yep, we're going to go there.
It's impossible to avoid, dear listener. We have to touch on some politics.
But we promise we're not going to give you 4 years of this.
Exactly. And this is a purely, it is a totally technical angle. So, yes, so it's definitely not off topic. But if you're easily offended by political, whatever you want to call it, discourse, then you might want to fast forward. But yeah, we're not going to get into policy or anything like that. It's more about how technology is affecting, what we said.
Yes.
How big data, social media are affecting our behavior.
Yes, but first.
But first, a little bit of housekeeping. Last week, I was really batting 1,000 in the Alzheimer's scale because I talked about two different shows, Unlimited and Transporters, and neither of those are shows.
Those things don't exist.
No. So if you Googled for those, you will not have come up with anything. As I discovered when I tried to write the show notes and I Googled for both and nothing came up. That's when I realized that they are actually called Limitless and Travelers. So not Unlimited or Transporters. Just some movies.
Just a small typo.
Yeah, just getting older is, it's no fun. But it beats the alternative. Okay, one more thing. We're up to 8 mailing list subscribers. We're on fire.
Woo, we're almost to double digits.
We literally are one person away from tripling our last week total. So dear listener, please sign up for our mailing list to see Kelly and I in your inbox, if you want to see Kelly and I in your inbox on a weekly basis, with show notes, links, corrections to the things I got wrong, and that sort of thing. Direct links to listen to the show right there. It couldn't be more convenient, and we're happy to offer this service for you free of charge. So just go to terrifyingrobotdog.com and look for the link that says Keep Me in the Loop.
Yes, and we'll throw a fun little extra video in there for you this week.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. I know what it is. It's not that fun. Our namesake got an upgrade.
Yes.
There's a brand new level of terrifying happening in the robot dog space.
No, it's even more terrifying-er.
Mm-hmm. It's, terrifying-er robot dog. So, look forward to that. Okay, shall we rip the Band-Aid off?
Yeah, let's.
All right. Okay, the jumping off point for this episode was an article. I don't remember who dug it up. I think it was you, Kelly.
Yeah, a friend of mine sent it to me.
Mm. And it was, ostensibly about big data, which probably anyone listening to the show would be familiar with the concept, where these days, since there is so much data available, because so much of our communication is happening in a digital space rather than a just meat space, that it can be recorded and mined for information and whatever, whether it's anonymous or not, certainly sentiment and all of the metadata that goes around the other things related to you or the person who said the thing creates just an amazing amount of data, which I've heard some people cleverly referring to as data exhaust, because it's almost like this thing that gets thrown off from the production of communications, and it's like this thing that in the real world back in the day, before we all had a supercomputer in our pocket, we would have done in person, and there really would have been no reasonable way to capture 99.99999% of the human communications prior to cell phones, really. Sure, there were chat rooms and things, but it was a rare person who was on their computer the same amount of time or the number of times that they are on their phone. And it only takes a quick glance around a bus stop or an airport terminal to see that this is true.
Yeah, I would say the vast majority of our communication these days takes place over text message and messengers, and hardly ever do you use your phone to actually make phone calls.
Yes. And in fact, I'll bet, dear listener, you're probably on your phone right now, based on our analytics about our listeners that we have available to us in Simplecast, which is what we use to host our...
Yes, based on our big data. at least 4 of the 8 of you are on your phone.
Exactly. So Okay, so now there's an it's not just that. Well, I guess I touched on it, but specifically we need to talk about social media because Facebook mm-hmm. cannot be ignored, and Instagram and WhatsApp Twitter, and Snapchat Twitter. And Twitter, yeah. Of course. How could I forget Twitter? And what that does, it's specifically Facebook is the really interesting one to me because Facebook has made it their business to collect. Perhaps they share it in an anonymous way, but they've made it their business to collect personal information about individuals and then sell that or sell ads against that. So sell it to advertisers, basically.
Yeah. What's the saying? If you're not paying for the service, then you're the product.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, over a billion active users. So that's nothing to sneeze at.
No, that's everybody does one thing and you've got a huge plethora of data mm-hmm. already. So,
yes. And so now I, in another life, I also, or another portion of my life, have dabbled in Facebook advertising. And let me tell you, it is spooky how specific you can get with the the tools they give you. You know, I mean, it's unreal.
Didn't some guy use it to specifically target his roommate?
Oh, I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, that's how specific you can get.
Right. So this guy is on Facebook and his roommate has set up ads that only he'll see. So the victim, if you want to call him that, the victim of the prank is getting ads in Facebook, which of course he's not going to assume he's the only person on planet Earth seeing.
Right.
But they're like, they're so incredibly specific. Like the dude was a sword swallower. And so his roommate was, if I remember correctly, he had some strange hobby like that.
Yeah.
And the roommate.
You're right.
Was posting ads to him and only, you know, that he was posting it to, I think you have to do a minimum of 100 people in your audience, but only he would see these.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, you know, information for sword swallowers. Did your roommate steal your lunch out of the refrigerator yesterday? He's like, what?
Yeah.
Dude, you got to see this ad. You know, it's like really freaking him out. But that's how targeted you can get. You could create ads that are targeted to such a small audience based on a wide range of factors that, you can find out what works through A/B testing on a 100 people, a group of 100 mm-hmm. people or people who live in a particular small town and A/B test it and create ads that are much more effective for those people. So where to go next from this? The thing that's crazy about it though, is that you can flip it around. It creates such a strong correlation is created between the data and what encourages people to take an action, whether it's click or sign up or whatever the action is. You can actually project into the future how those people will behave in future situations.
Based on the data you've already collected and the actions they've already taken.
Yes. And you don't know their names necessarily, but it doesn't matter because their profiles are so specific that you can just target people with that profile and odds are high or statistically significant at least that you'll get more of a result out of that group. And the reason that I know this or the reason that we know this is because there's a researcher in Cambridge, right? Cambridge, England?
Yes.
Who was doing studies into this area. And as he started to get into it, he realized that he was getting into a territory where it was like, whoa,
this is scary.
This is scary. Because he I'm trying to remember an example, but I remember one of them was kind of like, if you own a particular, you know, if you own like an American made truck, you're going to do this. Or you're going to react well to this, or you're going to be incensed by that, you know? So he started to recognize, they didn't go into like extreme detail, but the big point was that he was doing this research and he started to get freaked out by it. Like he was going down this rabbit hole and he's like, wow, this could be used. You know, it's one thing to be like, oh, we want to sell more sneakers.
It's another thing to be like, oh, we want to turn the tide of a presidential election.
Exactly. And it's not insignificant that this guy is not from the United States. So fast forward a little bit. I don't know how far we want to go into the sort of cloak and dagger piece of the story. Maybe we could just send people to the post. Because
the link. Yeah, it's a really good post.
Yeah, it's a fun read. And there is a little bit of like, sort of spy-ishness to it, or at least deceit and treachery. It's mm-hmm. good. So fast forward and the Brexit thing happens and this guy's colleagues who were familiar with his research were like, dude, what did you do? Because it was clear that what was happening was a result of this kind of research being implemented and brought to bear in an election. So he's like, I had nothing to do with this. I don't know.
This one wasn't me.
It totally wasn't me. Yes, the company who's taking credit for it has the word Cambridge in the name and they're from England, but it wasn't me. And, you know, so he was bummed. Like, he was sort of like, oh, I feel awful. And eventually this company came, they have a Cambridge Analytica, I think it is.
I believe it is, yeah.
And they've got their own sort of Dr. Evil leader guy who he's like sort of from the Julian Assange model.
Yes, very, very charismatic. And
yeah, and like the you know, tailored suits and the perfect hair and the whole thing and the accent. So, but he's basically bragging about it. He's going around bragging about it. He's like, we support, you know, our tools based on big data gathered through, I don't know if he admitted this. In fact, I think later they denied it, but, you know, data that they had gathered, which you can buy, but also presumably it was coming through Facebook likes as well, because Facebook later in response to this made them private by default instead of public.
Yes. And all of these hundreds of thousands of Facebook quizzes.
Mm-hmm. Which Harry Potter character are you?
Yeah.
And so you go through and you say all this information, then it's tied to all of the other things about you. And they, oh, that's right. They break it into the five personality types. The OCEAN is the acronym.
The acronym, yeah.
They break it into the five personality types and once they have that information so that they can target ads to those people, then they can do so, which opens up like a whole can of worms. So the first question is kind of like, well, is that good or bad? Because, you know, the way, you know, is it like fire that, you know, you can use it to burn down a building or you can use it to cook a hot dog?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Spider-Man had a saying about this.
Right. I believe you're correct. But so is it like, I can't quite bring myself, like, I want to say it's bad because things didn't go my way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it's no secret that I'm not a Trump voter. So, you know, things didn't go my way. Therefore, it's easy for me to say like, oh, this was a bad thing.
Yeah.
This is a bad thing that these people did. But if it worked for someone I supported, maybe I wouldn't care so much. So if I really want to be the liberal elite that I am, go ahead, call me it.
In your nice New England home there.
Yeah, exactly. I would have to say that it's how you use the tool. It's not necessarily good or bad because it doesn't, you know, let's say you use the exact same tools to help teens quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously good, right?
So unless you're the tobacco industry.
Well, so, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's kind of like the actions are good or bad. The tool is not necessarily good or bad. So I think attacking the tools is probably a bad thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Probably.
I mean, they may get used for things you disagree with and things that are subjectively and objectively bad. But at the same time, there's so much potential there for that to be used for good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Kelly and I are, you know, I don't know if we need to go into it, but we are working on a project that has to do with, you know, using social media to promote tools that help teenagers quit smoking. And it's such an obvious, like, how even they want to quit. Like, it's like a victimless use of the technology.
We're not convincing them. They're saying, hey, help me with this.
Yeah, we're not trying to trick them. So, which is the segue into the next thing where it's like the whole fake news thing and being like, okay, if you're in a situation where I think that I have stopped tracking the numbers because it's become absurd to do so, but something like 80% of the adult population in the United States has a supercomputer in their pocket and can connect with 4 to 5 billion people worldwide for free instantaneously through social media or whatever else, you know, it could be their own blog, but it seems like people don't do that so much anymore. It's mostly like, it feels like Twitter and Facebook mostly.
Yeah. All of the relevant and popular blogging seems to have moved to platforms like Medium.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Rather than an individual blog.
Right. And so all of those things, Twitter, let's say Facebook, Twitter, and Medium, because those are the ones that keep coming up on my radar as well, are, you know, they've got very slick mobile apps, make it extremely easy to share audio, video, short form, long form content. It's just, you know, everybody knows what social media is, but it's like, okay, the proliferation is pretty much it's pretty much saturated in the US. And when you get to a, if you have some, and how do you even get into this? If you get into a situation where anybody with like the enough, you know, a basic web super user, like anybody with the ability to throw together a WordPress site, which isn't an incredibly high bar.
No, it's not. And it gets lower all the time.
Yes.
Our job is to make that bar lower.
Yeah, our main day job, right.
Yeah.
So that means that anyone, this is a specific example. So someone who, in my opinion, is a jerk can set up, this is a specific person I'm talking about and we'll link to it, can set up a website that looks exactly like a local newspaper, has all of the trust indicators, like a masthead, a logo, just by ripping off another newspaper, just going to their site, copying the HTML, probably hot linking to all the assets, not even copying them over.
Right. Hard to do.
Right. And making a fake version of the Chicago Tribune or the Warwick Beacon or whatever. So to lend a post some, a completely made up story, to lend it some credibility by placing the made up story in the context of what looks like an old school newspaper website, and then feeding that into the social media machine and just watching it get millions of views, you know, get shared virally, because since the story's fiction, it's really easy to, especially with all the information that you can gather, like, oh, I know what makes people click on stuff. So I'm just going to make up a story that I know people will click on. And I'm going to present it like it's true so that people, because it wouldn't go viral if it didn't seem to be true.
Right. Yeah. It needs to be convincing, but you can use all that data to tailor the message specifically so it gets shared and spread and passed around among a very targeted group of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and I'm from a newspaper family. Like my dad's entire adult life was in a newspaper. I know that yellow journalism is a thing. I've seen the reality of a story and then how it gets printed in the paper and in other media outlets. And it's not perfect. You know, no. But this is complete fiction. And I'm not saying this because I think fake news exists. I'm basing this on an interview with a guy who did this to make a ton of money that we'll share in the show notes. I don't know if you and I have actually discussed this, but it was it's a great piece on NPR where one of the reporters just tracks some guy down that's behind one of these websites and goes and interviews him and he spills the beans. Maybe it's fake though. I don't know, but I trust. And so here's the segue, but I trust NPR. And I think the effect that has, it feels like things kind of came to a head with all of these sorts of uses of these tools. I've said repeatedly that I think through this election cycle, even before the election, I felt like social media jumped the shark. Like social media has entered a new phase where I have scores of friends who have told me that they've deleted social media from their phones completely. Because
there's no point anymore. It's like you can't trust it. It's not reliable. Yeah.
Even people that you like, you're just sick of hearing the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's like just like picking the scab endlessly with no, you know. And the other thing about it that really bothers me is that tweeting stuff and sharing links, it makes you feel like you did something, but you really didn't.
Yeah. All right.
And you know, I mean, did you do nothing? Yeah, you probably did more than nothing, but there's a lot of things you could do that would only be slightly harder, that would be much more effective.
Right.
So, okay. So, but the social media jumping the shark thing is a tangent. And this issue's come up before on the show, this issue of trust in an anonymous environment like the web or the internet in general, because we're talking even beyond browsers. How do you trust anybody? You know, like you almost have to go back to this sort of old world institutions.
You almost have to, but then there's, you know, what happens when like the traditional news outlets are having information withheld or maybe being deceived themselves. And I don't know, is this a good point to bring in the Twitter accounts, to mention the Twitter accounts? Or
it is. So yeah, go for it, because you were the one that found them.
Yeah. Speaking of trust, since all of this has started over the past couple of weeks, there have been all the political changes happening in the U.S. There have been several accounts pop up from people that claim to be from the EPA, from NASA, from NOAA, National Park Service, and even like staff inside the White House itself that are tweeting about, you know, things that are going on and information that they're not supposed to distribute and all that sort of thing. And there's no way to verify any of these things. You have to either take them at their word or not, because obviously if these accounts are legitimate, then no one wants to reveal their identity because they're going to either lose their job or their freedom. So
Brings up one of them has almost 1 million followers. I mean, it's not like, and going through the feed, it's the kind of thing that's more attractive to someone like me. You know, it's not, you know, ranting, finger pointing, appeal to emotional triggers. It's more like, look, these facts happened.
Right.
They're verifiable. It's not an opinion. And so I'm like, all right, but it's still a huge grain of salt, though, because it's so easy to imagine someone having a clever idea, especially the first one I saw was the parks one, or it might have been the EPA.
Yeah.
It was like all national parks or something. And there's a bunch of ones like Rogue NASA and that sort of thing. And it, on the one hand, it kind of doesn't matter if they're actually or not actually inside of the agency, if the information is correct.
Yeah, that's true, too.
But let's say they are inside the agencies, and there were some, you know, when the administration changeover happened, naturally, just like when Obama came in, they changed a bunch of websites and things, other accounts changed hands, like the POTUS account on Twitter changed hands, and things disappeared. You know, all of the Obama era tweets were deleted and they started fresh with Trump tweets.
Oh, wow. Did they delete all the old ones?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Twitter actually moved. I think they moved them over to POTUS 44.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it was like it started fresh. What was the other thing? And there was, you know, there were climate change pages taken down. You know, they've got an agenda and they weren't going to like host pages that were against their agenda.
Yeah.
So, okay, fine. That's your prerogative. But what do you do when there are people who just so thoroughly disagree with you that they're willing to take what probably is, I don't know how small a risk it is, how large or small a risk it is to be leaking information from inside NASA? Probably pretty big.
I feel at minimum you're risking your job.
Right. So, well, there's two components to risk. One is likelihood and the other is magnitude. So if, you know, if the, or impact. So like the risk, the likelihood of getting caught is, I bet you it's not that low. I bet you it feels lower than it actually is, because people know people and they're going to know the people in the office who are super angry, and it's almost certain that some personal information or some turn of phrase that sort of points the finger at somebody. I'll bet you the risk is the likelihood is probably not crazy low. Getting caught, and then the magnitude of the impact is, yeah, you probably lose your job for sure, and perhaps depending on your employment agreement, which could very well be this way.
Government clearance level.
Yeah, you could probably take a pretty serious hit. So what's the benefit of taking that risk, first of all, and what, if anything, could the administration do about it? So like, imagine again, it's easy to be like, oh, these people are heroes because they're on the side that we feel politically aligned with. But if it was the flip side and people were leaking, you know, the idea of leaks from the government is not a good thing, really. I think that secrets should exist. I think that there are situations where secrets make sense.
In certain situations, yes.
Yeah. And the problem is that the people who have the secrets are the ones that get to decide whether
to decide,
or not it's appropriate. So, I mean, I'm a huge fan of transparency, but I'm not going to say that everything should be public at all times. You know, I don't know. I think the question of whether it's good or bad that there are whistleblowers is probably not for us to decide. But the more interesting question is, what would you do to stop it? So let's say you think it's bad, like somebody is leaking information from your family, you know, like Kira's doxing you guys. For some reason.
An alt-shaver Twitter account.
Alt-shaver. And we have a title. So, like, what do you do? You know what I mean? I guess the only thing realistically, I don't think there's a technology solution.
No, I don't think so. I think this is a personnel issue.
Yeah, I think you go on a witch hunt. I think that you That was a loaded term. I think you do an investigation. because if you're the one, if you know the secrets and you can see that, yes, it's obviously someone from inside NASA because only they would know this, mm-hmm. then you're like, okay, there's a leak. There's a mole.
Yeah.
How do we find them?
And you start narrowing it down.
Yes. Like you leak information to just one person. You see if it creeps out. That's how I usually do it. But let's say you've got the FBI at your disposal and the NSA. There could be a technology way to locate the person, I suppose, right? I mean, could you say like, okay, you know, I'm sure people are allowed to have personal phones, whether or not they're allowed to use them for government work. You know, can you say, oh, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile. Yeah, we want records for all of these phone numbers for all of our employees.
During this time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You probably can. All right. So I guess talking about whistleblowers, you can't not mention Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. And the level of surveillance that the U.S. government is capable of evidently is extremely high. So you would think that maybe, you know, an administration that, let's say, had a freewheeling attitude toward the citizens' rights and privacy and so on and so forth.
Yes. All theoretical, mind you.
Yeah. Hypothetically. I don't know what, you know, who knows what the relationship is or between the agencies or who's allowed to tell who what to do exactly, if there'd be a fight about it or if like secret courts. Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah. But one thinks there would be ways to figure it out if you are so motivated. So what does that do? Does that do anything? Let's say there are a bunch of moles in a bunch of government agencies, mm-hmm. and they're silenced. What does that do? You know, the Twitter accounts disappear, or maybe they just go straight to Twitter. You know, a million people following rogue NASA, and the government approaches Twitter. You know, they've collaborated before,
and says shut it down.
And says shut that down.
Says give us the IP address where these tweets are coming from.
Right. Yeah. Here's a warrant. Do you have the information? And they shut it down one way or another. They either find the person or they don't, but the Twitter account disappears and those million followers are now like, oh, huh, now where do I go? You know, it seems like a whack-a-mole.
Yeah, it does. Because, I mean, you feel like another one would just pop up.
Right. So I think it goes back to, we were talking about before the show, I think it goes back to this kind of rebirth of traditional journalism because the problem with the anonymous posts is that while if they're really inside, the benefit of them is that they could potentially release information that is clearly useful or reveals, you know, like a Watergate tapes type of thing, where this is like, look, this is clearly illegal.
This is illegal and this is happening, yeah.
Right. And what does that end up doing? You know, just like, it still is going to take somebody to research it. Like, it's not automatically, oh, some anonymous account on Twitter said that this guy was guilty of this thing. So let's just start, let's convene right. a grand jury.
It might stir up something, but you still have to have people to stand up and investigate and say, no, this is wrong. We need to stop it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously that can happen a lot more easily if they know there's a reason for them to do that.
But yeah, there's a smoking gun. Right. So I wonder if now this had to come up, WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like what WikiLeaks on the surface at least claimed it wanted to be, which was like a place for whistleblowers to anonymously drop stuff so that journalists could then pick it up and kind of run with it, as happened with The Guardian and Snowden. So I feel like it comes back to, I feel like the social media stuff is kind of like, it has an effect on people's behavior and public opinion and all that. And in a situation where people are making a one-way decision, like you can't undo your vote for president.
Right.
There's like, as long as you can bring the populace to a fervor at the exact right moment, there's no really straightforward way to change your mind after the fact. There's no way to change your mind, and there's no straightforward way to undo it later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but outside of that, which is not a super common situation, you know, we have elections every couple of years, but it's not super common.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal when it happens, but it's not an everyday thing.
Right. But I think the everyday thing is more powerful potentially, and it's still enabled by technology where, you know, doing the research and the connections and looking for leads and clues and that sort of thing. Much of that can be done digitally, I'm sure. And, but I think it's just ultimately going to fall on journalists, like investigative journalists, investigative reporters who have a particular commitment and do it publicly and mm-hmm. have a reputation to lose and therefore wouldn't throw it away on some, you know, just getting somebody elected in this cycle. You know, like, why do we trust journalists? Why do I trust, I don't know, I can't even think of one.
There are news agencies I trust more than others.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm talking about like a specific person.
Okay.
Like, yeah. What was the, I can't believe I can't remember the reporter from The Guardian that broke the Snowden story. Cornelius Fudge, that was it. No.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the notion that I think, yeah, if this feels like to me the potential rebirth of the newspaper industry. Because of it, just because of, you know, based on anecdotal information from people who are deleting social media from their phones, they're not going near it. It's like radioactive, and maybe I'm sure that'll die down. But
yeah, I'm sure it will.
We've seen the dark side, and it's kind of forced a lot of my friends to say, "What am I really getting out of this?"
Yeah, I sort of had a moment like that. I don't follow many people on Facebook anyway. That's what I did. I did the Great Purge a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But I actually ended up blocking a few of the dozen or so that I have left. And I'm like, you know what am I getting out of this? Because one of the people that I blocked was a friend of mine whose political opinions I agree with. I just got tired of hearing it every 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here. You know, like, I post stuff to Facebook, but it's usually not from inside of Facebook. I'll be like, take a picture with my phone and share it to Facebook. And I don't actually go on Facebook. And when I do, it's all people I agree with. So,
yeah. It's just an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exhausting because, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, okay. I agree with your opinion, but I don't want to hear your angry rants about it constantly because staying angry constantly is not going to solve anything. And it's just stressing me out.
Yeah. I've even seen things happen where in the threads, people who agree about the overall topic will disagree about the way they're interpreting it. It's like just fighting everywhere. And so I'm like, all right, I'm out. And I didn't even use Facebook that much before, but I did use Twitter a lot for a long time. And then I deleted it for a long time. And then I put it back and turned off notifications. And that was a good balance for me. It was like having notifications off, but occasionally being able to share stuff.
Yeah, like I've tweeted and retweeted some political stuff over the past couple of weeks. And which, you know, I try not to do for reasons previously mentioned.
Mm.
Just because it gets exhausting and, you know, but
it's weird. It's cost you emotionally.
Yeah, it is costly. Some of it I felt like is too important not to, like.
Yeah, just like breathtakingly. Yeah, breathtakingly. Yeah. So there's definitely that the trend I'm seeing and I like is that people are being like, no, we need to do, you know, sharing this tweet is almost a non-action. Mm-hmm. And it's emotionally costly because someone's going to rag on you for doing it. So better is just call your representatives. If you know, whatever aisle, mm-hmm. whatever side of the aisle you're on, calling your representatives would be way better than like endlessly tweeting a bunch of angry rants, in my opinion. So, you know, I just feel like there are other things that can be done that are potentially more productive. And I'll tell you this, one of the major things that I use Twitter for and Facebook to a much lesser degree, mostly Twitter, was that was basically it turned into my RSS feed. So I used to follow RSS feeds and that's how I got my news. And then when Twitter became really popular for a while there, before it turned into a cesspool, that's where I got all my news and I stopped reading RSS feeds. And now I am paying for news subscriptions. So I like a thing that I thought there would never be a day when a paywall would make sense for publication. All of a sudden, the value is revealed to me because the sort of chickens have come home to roost. Like the things that all the newspapers said were bad about social media and free news online
have become true.
They finally happened. And now it's like, oh.
I'm about to do the same thing as far as paying for a news subscription, just because just the signal to noise ratio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I signed up for the FT, Financial Times, which I love for a bunch of reasons. One is that it's paid and it's not that cheap. Mm-hmm. So there's like, if there's any advertising, I've never seen it, you know, in the thing. So you don't have to have any of that. There's, it's all around. I'm not super into money, but the thing that I like about them being into money is that they're really apolitical. You know, they talk about politics all the time, but they don't care one way or the other.
Right. They don't have a bias. They're just looking at it from the perspective of
how it's going to affect the markets.
Changes on the financial markets and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no hysterics and it doesn't get you all riled up, really. It's just like these things happen. We think that the effect will be this and this. So it's really, I'm like, oh, wow, adults, adults, I found you. So no ads. It's really not slanted in any way because it's really just how to, you know, it's for investors really to decide what to do with their money and not about who should, you know, he said, she said, or who should win or who shouldn't win. So the language is all very neutral. I'm sure they have an agenda like everybody else, but you know, I love the New York Times for a lot of things, but they get hysterical and, and I just don't have the energy to be provoked that way when I'm really just trying to figure out what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
Like the Financial Times is not trying to incite you into action. It's like, hey, here's some information. Do what you want with it.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to go to a news site to read an opinion piece.
Yes. I mean, I don't mind some analysis, but I don't want a straight up editorial. You know, occasionally, but not every single day. And so, and like the Financial Times, since they're investing so much, you know, they've got the money to pay people to do longer form pieces, they'll only be like, I don't know, maybe 10 a day of which, you know, three of which I'm interested in.
Right.
So it's not this overwhelming flood of stuff. So after work, I can, you know, sit down for, I don't know, 30 minutes and feel like I'm caught up on stuff. And since it's outside the US, they have a really good, they're not overly focused just on the US. That's like a very global focus. That's kind of an oxymoron, but
yeah,
like what are you going to focus on, Mars? But it's I don't know, it's shocking to me because for years being like newspapers are dead, you know,
to see that come back around now because there's just so much noise and hostility and just like garbling of facts in social media and manipulation.
Right. So it comes back to like identity and brand and because those are things that they would lose. Those are valuable things that they would lose if they lost sight of their, I don't want to say mission, but you know, whatever their ideals are. If they compromise their ideals, everyone would leave.
Right.
So they can't. So they're kind of held in check by their commitment to their readers that they've built up over years and years and years. And that's suddenly appearing, you know, the value of that is suddenly painfully evident. So the comparison's unbelievable.
I've come to a similar conclusion over the last couple of weeks too, that it's something that I didn't think I would ever pay for before, but now it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. So like many, you know, just to kind of beat on my internet drum, like the newspaper industry still, what happened to other industries was that the middle fell out. So anything that was sort of mediocre or, that's kind of a harsh word, but really that's the thing. Like if you're kind of in the middle of the pack, that all got destroyed and it's not going to come back because they didn't have a reputation really, you know, unless they went hyper-local, like, you know, like our local paper or something like that. But big, big brand names that are sort of known and trusted globally, like whatever, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Al Jazeera, Financial Times, and you know, CNN. I don't know about CNN.
No, CNN.
I meant to say the BBC. That's what I meant to say. And you know, so those are like and NPR. Like I'm a big believer in NPR. So if that doesn't tell you I'm a liberal elite, then nothing will. Anyway, so I don't know. Is this a tech episode? I think it is.
I think so. It's definitely an example of how technology is changing how we interact with the world, because we've now seen how that technology can be harnessed to sway public opinion and manipulate votes and all sorts of things like that. And just, yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be happening if, you know, everybody didn't have a smartphone in their pocket.
No.
Because it would all be going through, you know, manipulation would still be happening in the, you know, the Willie, if you're old enough, you remember the Willie Horton videos and, you know, in yellow journalism, the newspapers that had an agenda and all that stuff. Definitely.
It would happen, but it wouldn't happen with the scale and efficiency.
Right. And there would be, I feel like the ability for anybody for virtually free to publish anything for any reason with no repercussions. That's the thing.
And with enough effort, make it look credible.
Yeah. Is kind of hijacks your trust in a way that's, yeah, it's hard to call that anything but manipulative. I mean, that's lying, basically. It's like, it's maybe a micron short of lying, but if you're swiping somebody else's look and feel to fake people out to think that they're on, you know, instead of being on the whatever, NewYorkTimes.com or NYTimes.com, it's NYTimes.co, and it looks just like the New York Times, and all the other content from that day's New York Times is there except for one phony story. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crossing the line. I think it's pretty clear that's crossing the line.
Right. That's lying to people. That's perjury or something.
It's something. It's some one of those urgeries.
Yeah.
Well, so there are a couple of, so okay, in the show notes, dear listener.
Wait, that's not the definition of perjury. Never mind.
Hey, we never said we were right.
No. But you know, give us a few minutes here to finish up this news article we're working on, and we can be.
Yeah. Let me go edit the Wikipedia page for the word perjury.
Yeah.
It's whatever Kelly says it is. Okay, so we've got a couple of really good bonus links, I think, for the show notes this week. So the article, I hope it was NPR. I think it was. It was certainly an NPR reporter. I don't remember if it was for NPR, but she tracked down this guy who had a network of phony news sites. There's an article about two former line cooks that did a similar thing where they're just like sitting in their house getting baked all day and then, you know, writing phony articles at night and then, you know, seeing how they did and tweaking them so that they'd get more links the next day. And we didn't even talk about bots and Twitter bots and all that stuff, but that's a whole separate issue.
Yeah.
But links to all those, links to the original article that kicked off this whole discussion about the big data researcher who's, you know, they closed the article by him shaking his head and saying, "I didn't build a bomb. I just showed people that it existed." I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So anything else that we should say before wrapping up? If anyone's still listening, thank you.
Yeah, if they're still listening, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's it.
All right. Next week, more self-driving cars or something fun like that.
Something fun.
Yeah. All right. That's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next week for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.
Would you like to see Kelly and I in our... Yeah, we kind of talked about this a lot, didn't we? Yeah, we can blow that off.